Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
The sun is blazing, and that's one hot dog. Could a nice summer haircut bring relief? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Well, I was always fascinated by the brain.
I don't know what the hell's about to happen to me. This is going to be crazy.
The first day I start taking care of patients as a doctor.
To reveal, to find the brain systems.
We recognize
club.
Big, round
you know, when you think
objects
about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea.
Yeah.
How many times have you,
over 25
I didn't see
that with your thumb.
The time when I'm healthy and I can almost hear the clock and I can feel like time's getting shorter.
On today's show, Wake Up and Weep, we check into post-surgery crying spells. Swallow this camera for an easier colonoscopy. And hey, kid, drop that iPad and get onto your bike. But first up, if you think it's hard to be a human during the hottest days of summer, try being a dog with all that extra hair. Some owners try to bring relief by giving their dog a haircut. But is that really the way to go? Peter Crimmins reports on the science of dog fur.
In the summertime, when the stifling heat and sweaty humidity come crushing down on you, imagine putting on a fur coat. It seems intuitive to want to take that fur off. I took an informal poll at the Schuylkill River Dog Run during 90-degree weather, and I found that owners have different ideas about giving their dogs a summer cut.
This is a short cut for the summer. Wheaton Terrier? They don't shed. They need a trim just to regulate the heat, I guess.
I give them trims. I mean, I groom them all the time, but I don't do what some people do, which is shave their dogs down in the summer.
We've never had her groomed. We just cut out the dreadlocks. I've heard that like the hair doesn't grow back right.
I normally take off his undercoat, not the outer hair itself, but most German Shepherds and dogs like him have like an undercoat. And I'm originally from India, so we had German Shepherds in India, where the heat is like perpetual.
Dog fur is complicated. Many dogs, even some short-haired breeds, have two layers of hair, an undercoat and an overcoat. In the winter, two fur coats is a great idea. In the summertime, it seems unbearable, but dogs do not experience heat the same way people do.
Dogs do not sweat through their skin. They get rid of heat, excess heat, by panting or through the pads of their paws.
That is Debbie Mandel. She works in the emergency room of the University of Pennsylvania's veterinary school.
Clipping them is not really going to give them extra release of heat through their skin, actually going to make them more susceptible to sunburn.
Mandel explains that layers of dog fur work together to form an insulation system, kind of like a thermos.
It can do hot or cold. They can trap cold air if they're in an air-conditioned house. They'll keep that layer of cold air close to their skin when they go outside. So it still protects them in the summer.
She stresses that dogs should not get haircuts. It does them more harm than good. Some owners disagree.
The same is true with veterinarians. Veterinarians have vastly different opinions on this.
This is another vet, Dr. Michael Cohen. He's with Center City Veterinarian.
I definitely have clients that say that their dog seems much happier when they shave them down. They just feel cooler. The other side of that is that I see dogs, especially Pomeranians or Arctic breeds like Huskies, their hair will not grow back correctly.
As it happens, I own a dog with a double coat. He's a Great Pyrenees mix. Watson was not designed to walk Philadelphia pavement in the summer. He was bred to live on a mountainside in France, guarding sheep. So in an attempt to make him more comfortable in the city, I brought him to a dog groomer. Courtney Golden, she works at Doggy Style in South Philadelphia.
So when we go downstairs, we're going to start with, he's going to get like a really good blowout first, to blow out all the loose coat. It'll help loosen some of these mats that are in the back.
Much as I try to stay on top of his grooming, Watson still gets mats in his fur. And there's hair all over the house.
It's totally up to you, though. People come in all the time and they know that, you know, they don't want to deal with the hair. But yeah, I would recommend a light trim on him, really.
Ultimately, a dog's health does not depend on a haircut. It depends on how well the owner manages his activity, whether in the Pyrenees Mountains or on the streets of Philadelphia. Dr. Cohen says it's natural to be lazy in August.
These dogs are not going to be running around on the trails in the middle of daylight with no shade. They're going to go under a tree somewhere nice and cool, maybe by, you know, a nice little stream, and they're going to chill out. I think they can be here with no problems as long as we don't try to force them on a run with no shade.
Most cases of heat stroke in dogs do not happen in late summer, but rather in the cooler temperatures of spring. Cohen says as soon as the days warm up after winter, owners who are itching to get outside take their dogs running before they can adapt to the season. So it's the dogs that suffer from the owner's enthusiasm. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
This is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. A sweeping piece of civil rights legislation celebrates its 25th anniversary this week.
Every man, woman, and child with a disability can now pass through once closed doors into a bright new era of equality, independence, and freedom.
George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act on July 26th of 1990, and we're going to take a look at some of the changes it has brought, first from a personal perspective. Wan Chin remembers what things were like before the ADA was established. He's a lawyer and served as the executive director of the Mayor's Commission on People with Disabilities in Philadelphia in 1994. Here's his story.
I was injured in June of 1986 after diving into a wave off of Long Beach Island, hitting a sandbar and breaking my neck. Left me paralyzed from the chest down with no use of my legs, limited use of my arms, and no use of my fingers. So when I got hurt, I had just finished my first year of college at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas. And I know I had a goal to go back, so I did go back in August of 1987. I was taking my LSATs, which are the law school entrance exams, probably the most important test I was going to take at that time. And there was no opportunity to request any type of reasonable accommodation for the test. And I took the test at TCU in one of those auditoriums. And I knew at least, well, there isn't going to be a desk there from my prior experience there. And I said, can I at least get a table or a desk so I could take the exam? And they said, we'll take care of it. And when I got there that morning, there was no desk, there was no table. And this is the LSATs, and I had to take them then because that timing of that test depended on when I was going to apply to law school, and so there was no postponing it. So we improvised. We got two chairs, just regular desk chairs, and they found a piece of plywood, and they put the plywood on top of the two chairs and made a desk. I mean, it was an interesting way to take the LSATs. The plywood was grainy and had chips in it, and it made filling in circles a bit difficult. It wasn't ideal, but you know, my mindset in 1986 was you adapt to whatever situations you have in front of you and you make the best of it. There was no law that I could point to or no rules that I could say, hey, you guys are violating this or you guys are violating that. It was just adapt and overcome. Getting upset back then wouldn't have accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. But I can tell you now, 28 years post my injury, 25 years post signing of the ADA, if I see a business or if I see a situation where the accessibility is not there, I do get upset. I mean, the ADA was a huge landmark piece of legislation that granted civil rights to probably the largest minority group in the country. It came with a price that many businesses and state governments and employers were questioning on how to fund. How were businesses going to make their places of business accessible? How much would it cost them? How much would the state governments need to make their public transit systems accessible? I would say back in 1994, when I took the job in the mayor's office, there were only a handful of buses, SEPTA buses, that had lifts on them. You know, they would finally find a bus that would have a lift on them and the driver would drive by. You know, the lift isn't working or it's too full, or they just kind of didn't want to be bothered by it. Now, I think if you look around the city of Philadelphia, just about every single bus is lift equipped or ramp equipped. You know, one of the hot issues right now facing cities, and not necessarily city government, is accessible taxi cabs. We see a couple around the city of Philadelphia. There's still instances where I go out there and I get frustrated thinking that we're 25 years post-ADA. Why can't I get into this store? Am I going to turn around and file a lawsuit? I don't know. That's just not the type of person I am. Am I going to take my business elsewhere? Absolutely. You know, my dollars are green just like everyone else's dollars, and I'm more than willing to take them to a business that understands and is welcoming to me. The curb cuts and the transportation, you know, they're governed by, you know, two parts of the ADA, which talk about public accommodations and state programs. I think the third part of the ADA, which I think is still something we deal with every day, is employment. You know, how do we employ people with disabilities? And that's a tougher question. You know, we need to bridge the gap between the needs of the employers and the needs of the people with disabilities and their need to find work. And I think once we can improve in that area, then we've really accomplished what I think the ADA was intended to accomplish.
Wan Shin is a lawyer with Ernst & Young in Philadelphia and has been on the board of the Inglis Foundation, an advocacy group for people with disabilities, since 2012. Karen Shukherjee produced this profile. So Shin mentioned the importance of work for people with disabilities, and joining us now to talk more about that very topic is Fred Maas. He's vice president of the Comcast Foundation and was recently chairman of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Fred, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
The numbers are not pretty when it comes to disability and employment, even though there are factors to consider, such as age. People with disabilities tend to be older. But give us a snapshot.
Sure. So if you think about the general population of people with disabilities in the United States, it's about 20%. So think of that. About 1 in 5 Americans has some type of disability. Of that, about 65% are employable. But the unemployment rate of people with disabilities is about twice of the average of what, you know, people who don't have a disability is. So I think there are many ways that we can help to overcome, you know, that disparity between the employed and unemployed.
Like what? What has to happen to change those numbers?
You know, while I think the ADA has made some great advancements as far as removing the physical barriers that exist for people with disabilities, it's been my experience that there are still attitudinal barriers. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about employing somebody with a disability. For instance, you know, workplace accommodations. I think a lot of employers still feel that to accommodate somebody with a disability, it's going to cost thousands and thousands of dollars, when in fact, the average workplace accommodation costs $500 or less. You know, they're probably going to need a lot of time off because of doctor's appointments and lots of other things, when in fact, the attendance rate for people with disabilities who are employed is much higher than folks who don't have some type of disability. Employee retention is another misconception. I think folks have a tendency to feel that people with disabilities are going to move around a lot from job to job once they're in the workforce. And the exact opposite is true. What you'll find is that people with disabilities who are employed by a company typically want to stay with that company because that company has shown an interest. So that employee has that just loyalty to that company. They want to stay. They'll stay longer.
Fred, you use a wheelchair. What have been some of the experience you've had in the workforce and some of the challenges you faced?
Sure. So, you know, all of my corporate work experience has been, you know, actually since I had my accident about 35 years ago. And it's been interesting. So my first corporate job 2 years after my accident was in a corporate setting. My office just happened to be on the second floor of a building that had no elevator. So every day, two guys who became some of my best friends would carry me, chair and all, to my office on the second floor. And now here we are, you know, all these years later, where elevators are in place, ramps are in place, you know, next to stairs, et cetera. So I would say for the most part, businesses are accessible.
Who can do the work of convincing employers that this is a good deal? Who are kind of the ambassadors?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's up to individuals and it's up to organizations. There are lots of great nonprofit organizations across the country that can help with educating employers. Easter Seals is one. The Ark is another. And on and on. But frankly, I think we as individuals with disabilities have to have a stronger voice and speak a little louder and say, you know what, we're here. We want to work. Let us help educate you about how to go about it.
Fred, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Fred Moss is vice president of the Comcast Foundation and is past chairman of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Coming up, we check into a mysterious phenomenon that involves a death-like sleep and tears. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca, offering resources to help patients afford and access their medicines. The AZ&Me patient assistance programs provided more than 382,000 patients in the U.S. with more than $670 million in savings in 2014. AstraZeneca Direct offers a range of patient support services, including delivery of brand-name prescription medications directly to a person's home. More at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mikan Scott. Questions beget questions, right? That's certainly true for reporters. A lot of times when we're working on one story, we stumble on another issue that's really worth looking into. That happened to me recently when I did a piece about surgeons and how they communicate the results of operations to patients.
Surgery. They want to know, obviously, are they healing satisfactorily? Are they healing at a normal rate? Does the wound look good? Is there...
For this story, I interviewed a bunch of recent surgery patients about their experiences, and we talked about that moment when you first wake up from anesthesia. And here's what I was hearing back.
You know, that's the weird part. So it's going to be embarrassing to say, but I woke up crying.
That's Sakia Gibbons. She was finishing college at the time, and she said she woke up from a major surgery, and suddenly she was really worried about a group project that she had to finish for one of her classes.
Oh, I have to type up this thing. They're going to be so mad at me. And the funny thing is I was reacting like disproportionate to how I actually felt, because in my head I knew like, oh, they'll be understanding, but my body was reacting. And the other time that I had surgery, I also cried, but... for no reason. I was just like, I'm just sad. And I was just boohooing.
The more patients I talked to, the more crying stories I heard. Here's Philadelphian Sarah Tebby. She had a hip replacement. She said she woke up and wept.
And a nurse came by and said, oh, honey, what's wrong? And I said, my dog died. And she said, oh, sugar, I'm sorry. When did your dog die? I said, 8 years ago. And I think it had actually been 5 years before that the dog had died.
I started to wonder if this was a thing, crying after anesthesia. So I asked around a bit and found out that nurses who work in recovery rooms are very familiar with this.
As patients are coming out of anesthesia, I notice sometimes tears rolling down their cheeks to outward bawling.
That's Esmond Almentasser. She's a nurse educator in the post-op care unit at Jefferson. So I tried to research this phenomenon and look at some studies, but I found nothing. Finally, anesthesiologist James Heitz told me I was searching in vain.
If you look at any of the major textbooks of anesthesiology, and there are three of them, you won't even find crying in the index. It's not even mentioned, but it's something that patients talk about.
Heitz teaches at Thomas Jefferson University, and he has just completed a book about post-anesthesia care. One whole chapter is dedicated to crying.
It occurs frequently enough that we should be aware of it as providers. It may generate some interest among the medical community. And if you look on the internet, if you Google crying after surgery, you will get pages and pages of information, and it's all generated by patients.
What Heitz is talking about is called pathological crying.
They're not in pain. They're not upset. They're not sad. They're not scared. But they'll be weeping.
Why this happens is unclear. Heitz says that all of anesthesia remains a mystery on many levels. For example, it's not even yet understood how exactly the process works. And there's no serious research on what aspect of going under makes some people cry when they wake up. The drugs used to sedate patients seem to play a role.
There's a medication called sevoflurane, which is a gas that we use commonly to keep patients asleep. There's some increased incidence of crying when that gas is used.
But Heitz suspects many factors could be involved. The stress of surgery combined with medications and feeling slightly disoriented. He says for children, crying after anesthesia is very common. It happens in about 30% to 40% of the cases. For adults, the numbers are much lower. He estimates them to be around 3%. But crying is not even something that gets written down in the patient notes. Nurse Esmond Almentasser says no matter what the cause, it's important to reassure her patients.
We hold their hands, touch their shoulder, wipe their tears, and just listen. Sometimes the best comfort we can give is just to stay silent and listen to them cry and just be there for them.
Heitz hopes that documenting this phenomenon could inspire some more research on the causes. Understanding it might help patients who suffer with pathological crying because of illnesses such as Parkinson's or because they've had a stroke. Have you had a similar experience? Did you wake up crying after anesthesia? We want to hear about it. Tell us about it. Go to our Facebook page. We are on Facebook/The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. 2 years ago, the country's largest doctors group, the American Medical Association, declared obesity a disease. Why? The move was supposed to nudge primary care providers to treat obesity more seriously. So the doctors had their say in 2013. Where does the debate stand now? Tanya English reports.
Health researcher Rebecca Poole says she also wanted to hear from the public. So the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity did a national survey. Turns out most people, about 70%, weren't even aware of the new classification. When we did our own informal sidewalk poll, tourists and office workers in Philadelphia had more questions than opinions.
Obesity is a disease? Geez.
Help people with obesity? How?
Does it necessarily have a cure?
I mean, which doctors would people normally see for obesity?
Rebecca Poole says ever since the big pronouncement from the American Medical Association, the obesity conversation has shifted. Americans are talking more about genetics, food availability, and all the other complex factors that can lead to weight gain. Poole says she's hearing more counterarguments to the messages from the diet industry, food marketers, and the fashion world.
These are messages that really say, you know, you can have whatever body you want. You just have to work hard. You just have to try the latest diet plan or the latest conventional new fad. And those kinds of messages are not only not accurate scientifically, but they really perpetuate bias and blame of people.
Excess fat can hurt health. It messes with appetite and makes it hard for the body to regulate blood sugar. And the Obesity Action Coalition says that definition fits obesity. Coalition volunteer Ted Kyle says to him, obesity is a disease, but he's careful about his language.
Calling someone obese is no better than calling someone handicapped or diabetic or autistic. You're defining the person by their health condition.
Body mass index is how most people define obesity. It's a calculation of weight and height. And if yours is above 30, you fall in the government's obese category. But the measurement is imperfect. Doctors say there are fit people who won't ever develop health problems because they carry more weight. Kimberly Massengill is an activist and photographer. Online, she uses the name Substantia Jones. She says BMI has become a sloppy shorthand for real medical diagnosis.
I'm fat, but I no more have obesity than I have shortness or I'm stricken with blue eyes.
Jones has red curly hair. She wears bright red lipstick. In any room, she stands out. As an activist, Jones uses her photography to give other big people that same visibility. She says her pictures fight sizeism.
A parade of hundreds of happy, naked, fat people, mostly women, some men, some transgender folks.
Jones hates the label obesity, but you can feel free to call her fat.
I say fat because the word fat is a morally neutral descriptor. The word overweight, however, is a term of judgment, suggesting that there is an agreed-upon line over which we mustn't exist.
Physicians have some of the same biases against fat people as the general public, and Jones worries that calling obesity a disease complicates the already tricky relationship between doctors and patients.
A doctor's first inclination is to say, you're having a symptom, you're fat, it's because you need to lose weight.
Jones says several of her friends were misdiagnosed because the doctor couldn't see beyond their size. Drexel University researcher Megan Buttrin knows about those worries, but she thinks the new classification will ultimately benefit the 2/3 of Americans who are overweight or obese.
It's actually the minority of adults now in the United States who are in the BMI range that we would consider to be healthy.
Buttrin says lots of us are able to shed pounds on our own, but nearly everyone creeps back to his or her original weight within 5 years. At Drexel, she studies how to keep that weight off.
You know, we don't expect when people have other diseases that they can just choose to cure themselves.
Buttrin hopes the new designation will open doors to obesity treatment. In recent years, the government approved 4 different weight loss drugs, but Medicare doesn't cover any of them. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. I was recently at a party and somebody complained about an upcoming appointment they had for a colonoscopy. They were really freaked out about every aspect of this procedure, especially, well, how do I put this delicately, the portion of somebody or something going up. Well, all right, there's no way to put this delicately, but I think you know what I'm talking about. There was another person at the party who was a medical researcher, and he said, oh, that whole procedure will be revolutionized within a few years, and you'll just be able to swallow a tiny camera. So everybody at this party was so excited about this idea. It was like the guy had just told them they had won the lottery. And I wondered, is that true? Is that really going to happen? Todd Bookman found out.
It turns out cameras are already in use for viewing another portion of the digestive tract, the small bowel. This rope of intestine is between the stomach and the colon, and about 20 years ago, the only way to get a decent view was by going down the throat with a procedure called sonde enteroscopy.
Sonde enteroscopy was a 9-foot-long scope, which is this.
For reasons that aren't entirely clear, Dr. Mitchell Kahn keeps one under his desk in a hard-sided case.
Let's see, where's the tip? This was how we used to do small bowel endoscopy. I pass it through the patient's nose into the stomach, then I put a scope down through the mouth and pass it and then drag it down to the small bowel.
So through the stomach.
Right, into the small bowel. I'd blow up the balloon, and then over the course of 8 hours, patient in the recovery room awake, I would slowly pull it out and look through. There wasn't even video. I would look through this thing here and examine the small bowel.
This examination was cutting-edge technology for patients with hard-to-pinpoint bleeding. But it was also a straight-up nightmare. That's why FDA approval of a swallowable camera made by a company called Given Imaging was such a big deal in 2001. Originally marketed as the M2A, or mouth-to-anus capsule, Given's rebranded pill cam is about the size of a big multivitamin. Inside, tiny cameras take tens of thousands of pictures as it snakes through your digestive tract.
Pictures get transmitted to a recording device that you wear, and then after the procedure, you download it onto the computer, and then you review it.
Kahn, a gastroenterologist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, says PillCam and its competitors are now the gold standard for looking inside the small bowel. But the large intestine, which is examined with a colonoscopy, that's another story. This part of your body is kind of like a long deflated balloon. The interior wall has lots of folds and pockets. That makes it harder for the cameras to spot things like polyps. Pietro Valdastri, an engineering professor at Vanderbilt University, says there's other shortcomings.
Another main problem is that the capsule has no way to interact with the tissue. So there is no way to get the tissue sample. There is no way for the capsule to remove a cancer.
Pill cameras right now are purely diagnostic. They can't biopsy or treat in any way. And they actually require more bowel prep, the drinking and trips to the bathroom that patients dread perhaps more than the scope. Because of its limitations, the FDA approved a pill cam for colons last year, but only in patients who couldn't otherwise receive a colonoscopy. Valdastri's research laboratory and many others are working on next-generation capsules. Everyone is well aware how badly patients want this option.
Hey, I've been in investor presentations when Given has gotten up there and showed how big this little camera pill is. And you can see everybody in the audience are eager to raise their hands and say, I want that.
Debbie Wang is an analyst with the research group Morningstar. She says while demand is there, there are other factors at play.
For gastroenterologists, doing a traditional colonoscopy is a big part of their bread and butter.
The pill cams cost less than a colonoscopy, right around $600 each, and they don't require the extra expense of an anesthesiologist. It also takes doctors longer to review the pictures from the camera, which means slowing down a busy practice. Mitchell Kahn at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital agrees the financial aspect is worth thinking through.
You know, value is quality over cost, so you got to decide whether or not the higher cost and the higher quality is better value than the lower cost and lower quality. So,
still, his hospital is set to become the first in the region to offer pill cam colon to patients later this summer. While these devices have their kinks to iron out, they can still shed light on places that are otherwise pretty hard to reach. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up, talking to your therapist can sound like this these days. Quick and easy, but what are the pros and cons? Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations that increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Do you remember your first bicycle, or learning how to ride it for that matter? Are you holding on? Are you still holding on? But once you mastered that skill, a bike meant freedom, autonomy, adventures. There is concern that this great joy is lost for a lot of today's kids who spend more time staring at screens than holding on to handlebars. But some programs around the country are trying to get kids back on their bikes and out into their communities. From KCUR in Kansas City, Alex Smith has this story.
And here are the kids.
On a warm afternoon at Garfield Elementary School in northeast Kansas City, a class of grade schoolers charge out into the schoolyard to spend an hour riding bikes. They're getting training from members of the nonprofit group Bike Walk KC. The program was created 3 years ago to teach bike safety skills, but organizer Maggie Priestmeyer says that she and fellow instructors found they would often be teaching children to ride for the first time.
I don't know where, you know, what their family situation is when they're 10 years old and they've never learned how to ride a bike.
The growing number of kids who don't or can't ride a bike isn't unique to this neighborhood or countless others around the United States. A new report by the National Sporting Goods Association estimates that just over 10 million kids in the U.S. between the ages of 6 and 18 biked regularly last year. based on nationwide surveys, that's fewer than half the number from 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's definitely a decline.
Marty Machacik of the National Sporting Goods Association says that adult cycling has remained pretty steady over the past decade or so, but the downward trend among kids has been dramatic, and it's just one aspect of a larger trend.
There's been a general decline and a concern pretty much throughout the country of the inactivity levels, not just for children, but all ages.
In a 2012 article in the medical journal Lancet, one researcher declared physical inactivity a global pandemic, and it's thought to play a big part in the 17% obesity rate among American children. Experts say physical inactivity heightens the risk of dying prematurely, dying of heart disease, and developing diabetes, colon cancer, and high blood pressure. Not only that, but inactive kids miss out on the benefits of regular exercise, which include better mental focus and motivation. Video games, along with TV, smartphones, and other high-tech distractions, may be factors in the decline of cycling among kids. Lots of studies show that the time kids once spent on sports, biking, and other physically active pursuits is now spent in front of a screen. But biking faces other challenges as well, according to Sarah Zimmerman of the National Center for Safe Routes to School.
There have been big changes in how our communities are designed.
Zimmerman is the Technical Assistance Director for the Safe Routes to School National Partnership, which encourages biking and walking to school. She says that in the late 60s, half of kids either biked or walked to nearby schools. But the breakdown of neighborhood schools, along with the advent of magnet schools and suburban sprawl, has changed that.
The biggest reason identified by parents for their kids not walking or biking to school is the fact that they live too far from the school.
Surveys by Safe Routes show that just about 13% of kids now either ride or walk to school. At the same time, the rates of kids taking the bus has remained about the same. That means more and more school children are getting car rides. Safe Routes hopes that by encouraging school districts to return their focus to neighborhood schools, they can reverse that trend. But that's not the only reason for the drop-off in biking.
There was just a huge surge in parental concern about abductions that happened.
And scare headlines have generated a rash of misplaced fears among parents, says Nancy McBride of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
The cases that we generally hear about are the cases that are the most tragic and awful for the child. So that scares everybody.
In fact, statistics show that just over 100 kids in the U.S. are kidnapped in public by strangers every year, a number that has remained pretty steady. Far more often, children are taken by relatives or family friends.
It doesn't mean that keeping our kids in the house is going to be the solution to the issue. What it means is that we, the adults, step up and do a really good job of supervising and monitoring our kids.
Now try to keep the bike straight. Keep pushing.
At Garfield Elementary, biking instructor Mary Estrada coaches a pair of sisters who grimace and giggle nervously. A few weeks ago, they didn't know how to ride, but now they're starting to get the hang of it.
Keep pedaling, keep pedaling. Wow, you did it, see?
Whether it's in extracurricular programs or through school districts, lots of kids are learning cycling in other cities, including Los Angeles, D.C., and Miami. And in Philadelphia, there's the Safe Routes Philly program. Although organizers focus on the health benefits of cycling, BikeWalk KC's Maggie Priestmeier admits that a big part of its appeal is the sheer fun of it all. The program may have not been created to teach first-timers, but she says it's become one of the most rewarding parts of her job.
When they ride, it's like the best thing that's ever happened to them, and you can see it in their face.
And if it can continue to replicate that excitement, maybe BikeWalk KC can begin to reverse those negative biking trends among kids. For The Pulse, I'm Alex Smith.
Good job.
Alex's story came to us from KCUR's reporting collaboration, the Heartland Health Monitor. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The medical community is slowly beginning to offer more services online, test results, scheduling, and even some virtual appointments. And there are talk therapists who are getting in on this. Therapy sessions via Skype, smartphone apps to help patients identify if they're feeling depressed or anxious and need to seek treatment. A tech startup called Talkspace has joined the fray. They offer web-based therapy for patients with limited time and money. Accessibility, convenience. Well, not so fast. Turns out therapy provided over the internet may come at a different price. Katie Heiler reports.
Catherine Glick is working three jobs. By day, she runs a mental health and addictions clinic in New Jersey and teaches an online course for therapy students. By night, she returns to her North Philly apartment to snuggle with her two cats, Bo and Wilma, and chat with 25 of her clients.
My colleagues make fun of me. They say I'm an angry typer.
Glick is a licensed professional counselor who practices therapy online through Talkspace, a platform that offers on-demand text messaging therapy. For $25 a week, users can communicate with an experienced, licensed therapist like Glick in a private, secure chat room on the Talkspace website or mobile app. Tonight, Glick is speaking with a gentleman who is struggling with some behavior issues that don't align with his strict religious beliefs. He's been her client for over a year. The average user spends around 6 months on Talkspace. But Glick has never seen his face and only knows his first name. Glick says the anonymity that the website offers allows her client to really open up.
He doesn't have to sugarcoat it. He doesn't have to lie to me about it because he's feeling shameful because he's seeing me face to face.
A user can post to the chat room whenever they like. Talkspace therapists are encouraged to respond when they can, usually at a rate that amounts to an hour of therapy a week. The format is especially good for users like Glick's client, who can't commit to a weekly traditional therapy session.
His life is jam-packed. If he had to go see someone face-to-face, he probably would not be able to make those sessions consistently. And after a while, he would probably just drop out.
Roughly 45 million Americans suffer from mental health issues each year, but nearly two-thirds of them are not receiving any care. Research shows that at least half of them don't get treated because they don't have access to therapy, can't afford it, or find it too stigmatizing. Most mental health providers have come to agree that online therapy has the potential to remove those barriers. But whether the world is ready for it to exist in the form of something like Talkspace is a much more challenging question to answer.
You know, so many industries were democratized by digital platforms. And it doesn't make any sense that psychotherapy, the only profession that is based only on communication, remained completely traditional.
Ronnie Frank co-founded Talkspace in 2012 as a website that could help you find and schedule a face-to-face session with a therapist, but it wasn't very popular. Instead, people were using the website's link to customer support to send Ronnie long, personal emails about the issues that had brought them to the site.
I was like, how come they're coming to me? There are many therapists on their site with, you know, nice pictures and bios and everything. And this is how we started realizing that people want to come to the site and just start messaging with a therapist without scheduling a session.
Frank says the new Talkspace website has nearly 120,000 users and has raised $13 million in funding to date. But while the company basks in the glow of its early success, it still faces some significant challenges. Online therapy may be as good as traditional therapy in treating anxiety and depression, according to some studies. On the other hand, treating a patient anonymously online can be dangerous if a person threatens to harm themselves or others. But the thing that truly threatens the long-term viability of Talkspace and online therapy in general is therapist licensing. Each Talkspace therapist has a license to practice in their own state. But when a therapist treats a client from another state online, the question becomes, where are they practicing?
So if there were a dispute to arise, if someone, a client committed suicide or something like that, what law would you look to? And I think a good plaintiff's attorney would probably look at both states and see whichever state's laws were most favorable.
That's Jason Zack, a Miami-based attorney with a degree in counseling psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. When it comes to regulating therapy over the internet, Zack says, it's sort of like the Wild West. Many states don't specify whether a therapist in their state can treat clients in another state online. The penalty for practicing psychology without a license can range from hundreds to thousands of dollars in fines and even jail time. Nicole Amesbury, head of clinical development at Talkspace, knows that the risk involved in online therapy is going to scare some therapists away.
Some people would want to shy away from that and say, well, this is a horrible idea. But then the loss there is so incredible because it's a crisis that so many people aren't getting help.
As Glick finishes up her day back at her Kensington apartment, she acknowledges the risk. It's one she's willing to take if it can help fulfill the Talkspace mission of making therapy accessible and affordable for all.
Even though I was sort of like very hesitant about online counseling and therapy, that spoke to me on a deeper level.
For The Pulse, I'm Katie Heiler.
You're listening to The Pulse. Sea creatures offer a lot of lessons for scientists. For example, earlier this year, a British engineer announced he had found the strongest natural material on Earth, the teeth of a type of sea snail called the limpet. The discovery could inspire a stronger-than-steel man-made material. Studying sea animals has also led to a better understanding of the nervous system, HIV, and cancer. But before scientists can get to work, someone has to get marine animals out of the sea and into their labs. The Pulse's Carolyn Beeler has this profile of David Remsen, whose job it is to do just that.
I first met David Remsen on a boat just off the coast of Cape Cod. He stood at the back of the research vessel as metal nets were lowered into the water. After they were pulled back up, he described the plankton, sea urchins, sea snails, and clams the team dumped on the deck. As he talked, he held a horseshoe crab in his left hand. Its spiky legs were wrapped around his fingers, and it remained firmly attached even as he waved his hands around when he talked. Remsen's ease with the prehistoric-looking sea creature comes from a lifetime of exposure to the ocean.
Well, I grew up in this little village, and my dad was a scientist here.
Here is Woods Hole, Massachusetts. It has a population of about 800, but it's home to six major marine research institutions.
You know, you can't swing a stick without hitting a marine biologist of some kind around here, and I just was exposed to this my whole life.
Remsen credits a summer science school in Woods Hole with igniting his passion for marine biology.
If you're going to get interested in science, what better way than mucking around with a bunch of seven-year-olds in the swamps and on the beaches, getting dirty and showing off in front of your friends, picking up critters, right? So that's how you get people introduced to science.
Remsen came back to Woods Hole to work during summers off from college, even putting in time milking horseshoe crab blood for pharmaceuticals. Now he manages the Marine Resources Department at the Marine Biological Laboratory.
Functionally, it means that I provide the marine animals that are used here for research and education. As I describe myself, I'm a glorified grocer. I run the grocery store that the shelves of which are full of marine animals. And instead of shopping carts, people come shopping with buckets.
Historically, marine animals have taught us a lot of what we know about reproduction and development. That's partly because sea creatures are fertilized and mature in clear ocean water instead of their mother's wombs, making it easier to study their growth. Today, a wide variety of marine animals serve as models for scientists looking for the next generation of human treatments and cures.
There are sea squirts here that can have their nerves severed and they will heal back. There are cucumbers that, when they are stressed by a predator, they will eject their entire digestive tract, and then they will grow a brand new one. And so people who are trying to understand how to regrow organs look at that.
After being plucked from the ocean, these sea squirts and cucumbers are held in Remsen's tank room.
So we are in the tank room. Can you just tell me where we are, what you have here?
Well, you'll probably can hear the sound of a lot of rushing water dripping and running through pipes. The tank room is a very large open area with lots of complicated plumbing and piping hanging from the ceilings and lots of tanks with water flowing in them on the floor. Most of the water coming through here is ambient water that we're pumping from across the street. We borrow it from the sea for 5 minutes. It goes into the troughs and it just goes back out into the sea. So
give me a couple examples of the kind of creatures we have in here today.
Well, you can see this large display tank in front of us has a skate, which is a type of ray. This is called a barn door skate. There's also some large flounder in here called fluke. That's that big guy back over there.
There are horseshoe crabs, squid, sharks, and lots of fish embryos. Much of the research at the Marine Biological Laboratory still focuses on reproduction and development. So a lot of the collecting happens in late spring and early summer. That's when specimens are full of eggs.
And then we put them into cooler water. We slowly cool them down in order for them to think that it's not quite yet time to spawn. And then when they're ready to be used, a researcher will come. They will then warm them up to what is the normal temperature. The animal will say, oh, it's summer suddenly, and let's have a party, and they spawn, and then they can get the eggs and embryos at the stage that they want to use them.
Remsen doesn't just serve researchers in Woods Hole. He ships everything from sea urchins to cuttlefish to scientists around the world, powered by an excitement for what creatures of the ocean can teach us about life on dry land.
It's just fascinating that as one learns about the natural history of the organism, and as these different species exhibit all these different strategies for living, that they can be used to improve our understanding of life in general and in the human condition.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Karen Shikurji is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? You can subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website. whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can get in touch with us. We always love to hear from you. Send us your questions, your feedback, and your story ideas. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.